Hello and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. What's at stake as Tim Walz and J.D. Vance take the stage in tonight's vice presidential debate? Mayor Johnson delays his budget address as the city works to close a billion-dollar gap. Our Spotlight Politics team on that and more.
All that hog butchering, wheat stacking, and tool making will really build up your deltoids.
And the city of big shoulders, the Windy City, the Second City. WTTW News explains how Chicago got its nicknames. And now to some of today's top stories. Iran fires an estimated 200 missiles on Israel today as the region-wide conflict grows. Iran says the attack that focused on Israel's security and military targets was in response to the killing of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon. U.S. State Department officials say they are coordinating with Israel on a response and that Iran must face consequences. The Israeli military says it was not aware of any casualties. Meanwhile, reports say Israel's strikes in Lebanon have killed hundreds and displaced thousands. Chicago police are charging a 15-year-old boy with the death of a postal worker shot and killed on duty this summer. Police say a months-long investigation along with the U.S. Marshals Service led to the arrest yesterday in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The U.S. Postal Service says 48-year-old Octavia Redmond was on her route in the West Pullman neighborhood in mid-July when a juvenile got out of a stolen SUV, approached her, and shot multiple times at close range before fleeing in a vehicle. Local postal workers weighed in today on the arrest.
And then when I found out how old he was, I was like, wow, that was just, it was just unfortunate that our sister had to lose her life. And whatever they come out in court, finding the reason why, the motive, you know, but, you know, it'll bring closure hopefully to the family as we try to heal and move forward without her.
Postal workers were rallying today as part of a national day of action in 90 cities across the country. They're calling on the federal government to increase staffing and improve customer service. A fiction writer and a visual artist are the two Chicagoans in this year's crop of MacArthur Fellows, also known as geniuses.
One reason that fiction is powerful is that it's able to imagine alternate realities in which our buried selves are allowed to exist.
I'm interested in the ways that dress and varying materials are used as tools of power, and how those tools are essentially used by those deemed socially invisible to carve themselves into a presence.
That first genius you heard from was Ling Ma, author of the post-apocalyptic novel Severance and returning to the University of Chicago next year. The MacArthur Foundation says her work, quote, provides readers with startling vantage points on the alienating aspects of contemporary life and the roles we play in perpetuating them. The other local recipient is artist Ebony G. Patterson. The foundation says Patterson's work, quote, shines a light in places she will not allow us to look away from. Congrats to the geniuses. Up next, what to be on the lookout for from both vice presidential candidates during tonight's debate, right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Ohio Senator J.D. Vance are taking the stage in New York City tonight to face off in the first and likely only vice presidential debate of the campaign season. There's just over a month until Election Day, so stakes are high. And tonight's rules are similar to the last two debates. No live audience and no written notes, but mics will not be muted this time. Joining us to talk more in depth are Jose Sanchez Molina, a communications and political consultant who previously served as deputy press secretary for Governor J.B. Pritzker. And via Zoom, we have Michael Chad Heppner, a coach to presidential candidates and author of the upcoming novel, Don't Say Which sounds like something I should probably read. Gentlemen, thanks to you both for joining me. Jose Sanchez Molina, let's start with you, please. Historically, presidential running mates and debates, they don't really sway voters very significantly. But this election has been anything but normal. Is tonight going to have a big consequences in the sway of the election's outcome?
Yeah, first, thank you for having me on. CBS actually conducted a poll where they found anywhere between a quarter to a third of the people that are going to be tuning in are looking at this debate to help them inform who's going to vote for them. I think what we're going to see from candidates is they're going to attack their bosses. They were both hired and brought on to be attack dogs, and that's, I think, what we're going to see today.
Michael Chad Heppner, let's talk a little bit about each candidate's debate style, starting with Tim Walz. The governor is known as Coach Walz, an affable Midwest dad. What are his strengths going in, and where do you think he needs improvement?
Sure. What's interesting is you've seen, of course, recently, everyone saying that, you know, he's the inferior debater and that Judy Vance is a much more accomplished debater. There's a missing thread there, which is Tim Walz is actually a very commanding communicator when it comes to delivery. So not just what he says, but how he says it when he's unleashed on larger platforms and larger stages. If you watch him in an arena or a large rally, he uses tons of vocal variety. His enunciation is dynamic and decisive. He looks around the entire room. He's free and very expressive. Now, in these smaller situations, he can become much more constrained and, in fact, even get sort of stuck on different syllables, perhaps search for words a little bit more. So essential for him is that he's able to keep that same level of ease and expressivity that he does in those larger situations. I think he will be able to do that, but we'll find out tonight.
Jose Vance is also technically a Midwest dad, but he's known for his book Hillbilly Elegy, his Ivy League education, of course. What would you say are his strengths, and where does he need to improve?
Yeah, his strengths lie in that he's been able to double down on everything that Trump has been able to say. Some of his weaknesses include sometimes even going beyond what Trump has said, you know, attacking immigrants, saying that they eat pets, and then when being called out, double down on that. I think Walz has a great opportunity to attack him on some of that. And at the same time, the governor has an extensive history of legislative victories. So to the point that was made earlier, making wonky policy seem exciting, that's a great opportunity for him to be able to come in and tout that.
Vance has, you mentioned the childless cat ladies rhetoric, and he's had to defend plenty of comments, that one included, as well as, of course, what he said about Haitian migrants in his home state eating cats and dogs. If that comes up, how should he respond?
He should own it, apologize, say that it was the wrong thing to do, and then come back to the issues. But what we've seen time and time again is, I think on Twitter, he even said, well, sometimes you have to lie a little bit, because no matter what, immigrants are attacking our country. And so that's the type of rhetoric that I think turns voters away from him. But this is an opportunity to correct some of those mistakes.
Michael, same question to you. If Vance should receive those questions about childless cat ladies and what he has said about migrants in Ohio, how should he respond?
Well, my answer might surprise you, which is that if I'm on his team, I don't actually care all that much what he says. Here's why. He says he's really inflammatory things a lot. Pretty incendiary things. And yet, if you look at how he actually delivers them, in particular, how stoic and even static at times his face is. Interestingly, his brow almost never moves. And this goes all the way back to like Hillbilly Elegy era of a decade ago. He's very immobile. And what this ends up conveying is that many of the statements that seem quite combative or incendiary on the page can actually seem more moderate, more even-keeled, more even tempered when he's delivering them. Now, I'm not saying that it doesn't matter what you say, it does, for sure. But probably more of the task for him tonight is to make sure that he comes across as someone who is not quite as inflammatory and as incendiary as he may be portrayed in the media if people are only looking at the content of what he says, meaning the actual words. Now, the flip side of that is actually if he gets assertive, forceful, fast with his speech, stepping on every single opening he possibly can, like that a little bit, then he actually might shoot himself in the foot no matter what he says.
Michael, Governor Walz, he's helped to create some of the narrative about his own opposition, calling them weird, reinforcing that the Democratic ticket is nice and normal and safe. Has that been a winning tactic, or if he continues to pursue it, could it backfire?
Yeah, I think without a doubt it was a winning tactic if the goal was to get on the ticket. I mean, in large part, that seems to be what promoted him and propelled him. I do think that he has been a more effective carrier of that message than others. And if you listen to him, he has a remarkable ability to slice and dice language together. I'll give you one example. At his rallies, you will often hear him say, "Holy hell," as this expression. Now, that's about as far as you can go tiptoeing up to profanity, but then he softens it with usually using it as some kind of a compliment. So he's actually very skilled at walking this fine line of irreverent, even provocative language, but making it feel, you know, quite welcoming, quite inclusive. And I think actually that's how he was able to use that very word, weird, in a specific way that seemed to stick. Could he overplay that? Maybe. It probably depends on how weird the stuff is that J.D. Vance says tonight.
It sounds like it's going to be a juicy debate the way the two of you are describing it, because as we mentioned earlier, mics are not going to be muted. Jose, how do you think that's going to play for either candidate, just because neither of them is known to be as interruptive as former President Trump can be?
If I was on Walz's camp, one of the things that I would advise him on is to let some of the things that J.D. Vance say sometimes sit. We've seen them time and time again come across as a little awkward, and I think the lack of crowd is going to make that silence is going to make that seem a little bit more awkward. At the same time, I think Governor Walz has an opportunity to really introduce himself to the American people, really get out there, and again, I think tout some of the legislative victories that he has been able to have, because they're the same type of policy proposals that the Democrats are proposing at larger at the federal level.
Michael, we're often looking for, you know, a headline, a big moment, especially, you know, us journalists. What are we going to be talking about tomorrow? How can those moments be created without seeming rehearsed or practiced?
Sure. Let me, though, back up and actually double down on something that Jose just said. I could not agree more about letting some of those Vance lines just land and marinate a little bit and sit there, but for a different reason. Here's why. J.D. Vance, say what you want about him as a speaker, but he is hyper-articulate. His linguistic precision is very, very high. In other words, anytime he opens his mouth, it appears as though he's in command of the words that are coming out of it, even if they're inflammatory or incendiary. And that is, he has very few ums and ahs. He has very few non-fluencies, very few stumbles. He's good at choosing words and choosing them quickly. Walz is probably not going to be able to keep up in that same way. So I wouldn't even try to necessarily top him with speed of entrance or speed of response or speed of speech. In fact, I would cut entirely the other way. And a lot of what he has going for him is his affable, relaxed, more sort of medium-tempoed kind of dynamic. He should lean into that. And in fact, the more that J.D. Vance may try to push the pace to try to get every single point in and win every point, it might actually boomerang and make Walz look better. Now, to your question, though, about manufacturing these points, you know, what's interesting is people don't actually give Tim Walz credit for being as good as he is at doing what theater professionals and actors call same but different. What that means is he can give a stump speech in which he's saying essentially the exact same thing, but it sounds a little bit different each time he does it. And that's the essential thing with attack lines, is they have to sound as though they're coming out of the person's mouth for the first time. So if they have a few of these rehearsed zingers, I think he might be able to pull them off.
All right, it'll be fun to see which ones play. 15 seconds, Jose. What do you think needs to happen tomorrow after tonight's debate?
I think they each need to take, each camp needs to take what each candidate said about the other. They're going to attack the presidential candidates. So really, I think it's going to be reflective of the party, the platform, and where they're coming from. One party has focused on doing right by the American people. Another party has focused on doubling down on some of the racist and sexist things that they've said.
All right, take what they've said and run with it. We're going to have to leave it there for now. Jose Sanchez Molina and Michael Chad Hapner, thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, what to know about the city budget. Our Spotlight Politics team on that and much more right after this. Mayor Johnson delays his budget address as he works to close a billion-dollar gap. Meanwhile, city lawyers recommend a settlement highlighting the high cost of high-speed police chases. And with 5 weeks until the election, early voting gets underway. Here with all that and more is our Spotlight Politics team, Heather Sharone and Nick Blumberg. Hey, gang, welcome back. So we know a coalition of groups, they've been sending out these campaign-style flyers in various wards targeting Alder people for supporting or opposing a plan to phase out natural gas hookups in new construction. Nick, what were you able to find out here?
That's right, Brandis. These are the kinds of mailers we might expect during a city election year, but in fact, they are targeting Alders because they are concerned about this ordinance, as you mentioned, new natural gas hookups. There have been a lot of groups, including People's Gas, unions, trade organizations, that have been pushing back against this measure. They say it's decarbonization without a plan, but those mailers did not have any information about who sent them out. We were able to learn that the operating Engineers Union Local 150 was at least one of the organizations that helped to bankrupt these mailers. A representative said,
"Bankroll the mailers."
Hello, I might need a little afternoon coffee. Bankroll the mailers, and they said that they were part of a broad coalition of groups involved with them, although they didn't give any other specifics. Now, Alderwoman Maria Haddon, who has been sponsoring this ordinance, said, "This is the kind of mailer that, if you're going to make these accusations, including claims that she says are false about what the ordinance would actually do, you should put your name on them." But fortunately, we were able to determine at least some of who is behind these that have been just flooding Chicagoans' mailboxes across the city this week.
All right. Thank you, Nick. So moving on to the budget. Mayor's postponing his budget address, we know, by 2 weeks, grappling with this billion-dollar deficit. Heather, how significant is this delay?
Well, it's definitely unusual, and I think it's a sign of the magnitude of the problem that the mayor is confronting. It will also mean less rest for Alder people, oh, and me. But he will give his budget address the day before Halloween, and the first of two scheduled budget votes would be the day before Thanksgiving, which is a day most Alder people, and again, me, like to be focused on the holiday. But that's the schedule, at least for right now. There will be lots of questions about what exactly the mayor is going to ask the city council to do, and that is sort of sucking up all of the oxygen in the room right now.
I'll make you a batch of cranberry sauce to help out.
Thank you. I know. Lots of questions about that also, and maybe we could pick different dates, y'all.
Yeah.
Nick, okay, so as Heather mentioned, you know, council's got 2 weeks for budget hearings. What kind of scrutiny is this budget going to face?
Well, I think it depends a lot upon what city officials are able to do with those extra couple of weeks. It's not a ton of time, but it seems like, you know, they could use this to try and scramble and come up with some options here. The reception depends a lot upon what's in the mayor's proposal. Is this going to be, you know, a request for a big hike in taxes and fees? Is this going to be sort of a doomsday budget, laying out all these possible draconian cuts? Is there a middle way? And, you know, the mayor went through a very contentious budgeting process, as Heather knows well, last year when there was this huge question about funding for migrants, which ultimately the city didn't even need all of, as it turned out. So, you know, he's not necessarily going to have an easy road with this either way, given the current makeup of the council and his relationship with Alder people. But the reception is going to depend upon, you know, a lot upon what he puts forward.
So moving on to something that's definitely not going to help solve this budget crisis, city lawyers are asking Alders to approve a $1.75 million settlement to a man injured by a driver being chased by police. Then we, of course, heard overnight about another police pursuit ending with a fatality in McKinley Park. One person died, two others injured. Heather, what are the rules on police pursuits and what are the costs to citizens of Chicago?
So since 2019, it has cost Chicago taxpayers more than $74 million to resolve lawsuits sparked by police pursuits. So this is a massive drain on the city's treasury. That was in part why former Mayor Lori Lightfoot changed the rules regarding police pursuits to require police to be sort of investigating or trying to detain somebody suspected of a serious crime. So it's no longer a misdemeanor or a traffic violation that it could spark a pursuit. However, this pursuit that they're looking to settle the lawsuit from was before those rules were changed. And in fact, the city tried to sue the man who fled police to try to get him to pay the costs of the person who was injured. He doesn't have any assets, so the city is going to have to bear the entire cost.
Moving on to schools, because it's been a couple of weeks, hasn't it? Pedro Martinez, school CEO, he was scheduled to appear before city council later this week. That hearing conflicted with Rosh Hashanah. Nick, Martinez, though, he's still in the midst of, you know, some very tense negotiations over the Chicago Teachers Union contract. And their most recent request is kind of interesting. What do they have?
Well, they are looking, they have put a proposal across the table today that looks to basically extend Martinez's termination terms and his contract to all employees that are covered by the CTU contract. Now, the CEO, it has a six-month window, basically, after he is terminated, if it is without cause. He continues to be paid for 6 months under the terms of the deal that he negotiated when he took over. CTU leaders say, we want this for everybody who's covered by the contract. Now, it is vanishingly unlikely that they are going to get such a provision in their contract, but this is another effort to kind of needle CPS and CPS leadership, saying, you know, we want this guy out, and hey, if he gets these, you know, relatively generous terms when he's dismissed, we think this is something that everyone under the CTU contract should be getting. But again, I would not be holding my breath for that.
Me either. 5 weeks to go until the election, Nick. Early voting already underway in some places.
That's right. Basically everywhere in Illinois other than the city of Chicago and Cook County. City starts this week. County starts next week. What's interesting is that we heard on Friday from the state GOP that said 180,000 Republicans have pledged to vote early. That's a big about-face from the kind of attitude that Republicans in Illinois and nationwide have historically had about early voting. But clearly, they see this is a disadvantage they've had to contend with in several previous elections, and they want to say, you know, that basically they're saying, if this is the law, then we're going to try and take advantage of it.
And yeah, we definitely heard some of that rhetoric during the RNC, during the Republican National Convention as well, which was surprising at the time. They're going with it now. That is Spotlight. We'll do it again next week, gang. Heather Sharon and Nick Lundberg, thank you.
Thank you.
And in case you couldn't tell, our newsroom loves exploring the backstory on complicated issues that matter most to you. Sign up for our email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, for a daily dose of what's happening and why. Visit WTTW.com/newsletter to have it in your inbox tomorrow morning. Up next, how Chicago got its many nicknames. The Second City is second to none. That is, if you ask readers of the magazine Condé Nast Traveler. They voted Chicago as the best big city in the U.S. for the 8th year in a row. So that got us thinking about our beloved city's nicknames and where they came from. Erica Gunderson takes on that question in the latest from our digital series, WTTW News Explains.
When it comes to nicknames, Chicago sure has gotten stuck with some stinkers. Maybe it's because the city's actual name comes from a smelly wild onion. Or maybe it's because other cities like to drag our city through the mud. In fact, one of Chicago's first nicknames was Mud City. Accurate, if not exactly flattering. Then there's Chicago's best-known nickname, the Windy City. Sounds about right to anyone who's caught a face full of Frosty Lake wind in January, but Chicago is only the 12th windiest city in the U.S. A lot of folks think the Windy City moniker came from New York. When brash upstart Chicago was competing to host the 1893 World's Fair, the New York Sun editorialized our politicians as, quote, full of hot air. But references to Chicago as the Windy City long predate that slander. The Cincinnati Enquirer used it in an 1876 headline to report on a tornado that blew through Chicago, though historians say there was likely a double meaning at play there, too. Fast forward to 1914 and a beefed-up Chicago. In his poem, Chicago, Carl Sandburg characterized the growing city as a young working man. In his words, stormy, husky, brawling. A line from that poem gave us the nickname City of Big Shoulders. Makes sense. All that hog butchering, wheat stacking, and tool making will really build up your deltoids. Chicago's most contentious nickname might be the Second City. Some believe it was sparked by the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, when the city had to rebuild, emerging as a stronger, more resilient Second Chicago. But Chicago was America's second most populous city for nearly a century, so it more likely started there. And annoyingly, it was a New Yorker's poison pen that made it stick. When writer A.J. Liebling found himself marooned in Chicago for a few years in the late 1940s, he wrote a collection of essays outlining all the ways he felt Chicago fell short of his hometown. The book was titled Chicago, the Second City. But in classic Chicago fashion, we embraced a name meant to run us down and used it to lift us up instead. because you, we're from Chicago.
Classic. For more in our Emmy Award-winning series, WTTW News Explains, head to our website. We tackle everything from why Chicago's pension debt is so high to why you can't buy a car on Sundays in Illinois. Go to WTTW.com/explains to get those answers and more. And that's our show for this Tuesday night. Stay connected with our newsroom and what we're working on by following us on Instagram at WTTW Chicago. And check out our website for stories you may have missed, like our reporting on a new contract for Fermilab, granted during a turbulent period for the research facility. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10, exploring the hidden history of Black civil rights with the author of the book Before the Movement. And a new trolley tour on the city's west side celebrates the neighborhood's green spaces. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm committed to giving back to the community through law and philanthropy.